The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 299.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Welcome to the Sunday live stream. First announcement is I've decided that I am going to rent an RV and drive to Miami. That is correct. I've got to be in Miami on the 12th or the 13th for my good buddy Mark Moss's live event there. And so I figured, well, I'll just rent an RV. And starting like the Monday prior, I'm going to drive down I-10. So that means, where am I headed? From here, Tucson, then to what, El Paso, then to San Antonio, then to Houston, then to Louisiana. But the bottom line is we're going to pick out maybe, we're going to drive for about 4 or 5 hours a day or whatever it is. And each night, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, or maybe Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, however it works out, we're going to stop at like an RV location and like an RV park or something. And we're just going to do a meetup there. So like just maybe do barbecue, or I can give out some end the Fed hats or something like that. Just whoever wants to show up. We get, you know, 5 or 10 people there or something like that. But see, whoever is in the area that wants to show up for an hour or two and maybe have a couple beers and have some food and talk macro and freedom and liberty, you're more than welcome to show up. So if that's something that you're interested in doing, go ahead and email my assistant. Her name is Adriana, and her email address is contact@georgegammon.com. And just let her know, say, hey, I'm interested in going to one of the meetups, and this would be the week just prior to the 12th. So what would that be, like the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, something, or 8th, 9th, 11th, or maybe 7th, 8th, 9th, you know, something like that. Just that week. And then when we get the calendar set up and the RV parks where we're going to be stopping for the night, I'll have her email you. And like I said, whoever wants to show up can show up, and we can have a fun night of just sitting around barbecuing, talking macro, liberty, and freedom. Things that I like talking about. All right, let's get into the live stream here. First question, what do we got? Can corporations, hedge funds that have accounts at the Fed use? Well, first of all, hedge funds don't have any accounts with the Fed. That would be, nor do corporations. So other than banks, I mean, those banks are technically corporations. So the big banks, the JP Morgan, really it's just banks and the like Fannie Freddie. So most corporations, like you're probably thinking like Ford or something like that, they don't have an account with the Fed, nor do hedge funds. So that have accounts at the Fed use unlimited amounts of bonds. How does it work? Thanks. Well, yeah, I think I can't really answer your question because your premise is off. So the dollars that are on the balance sheets of most of these corporations and hedge funds, they're not liabilities of the Fed. They're liabilities of banks in the private sector. So when the Fed does QE, as an example, they're which I think is where you're going with that, they're not doing QE directly with hedge funds or corporations or something like that. Now, as far as when they did those bailouts, like the MILF program or whatever the 4 and 5 letter abbreviations were back in March, April, 2020, when they're basically buying junk debt and buying corporate bonds, that may be applicable, but they have to do that through an intermediary. So it's again, because those accounts, they don't have reserve accounts with the Fed, is where I'm going with that. Okay, next question. What is a more systemic risk to the financial system, Chinese real estate debacle or the energy crisis? They're both big risks, Benjamin. So the Chinese real estate debacle is a big deal because it's such a large, it's not just Chinese real estate. Let's think this through. It's really the fact that China goes through a recession or a depression. What does that do? Okay, well, that reduces their demand for imports and they most likely produce less stuff. So less demand for imports means they're settling, let's say 50% of those transactions in dollars. That means fewer dollars circulating in the global economy. In addition to that, if they're not exporting as much because they're not producing as much, so they have to consume a larger percentage of what they produce domestically, then that means fewer dollars coming in. So it's this interesting dynamic where you could have the dollar go up on the DXY against other currencies because of the global dollar denominated debt, while at the same time, you could have significant price inflation and shortages of stuff in the United States. Now, right now, I would argue that the supply shortages that we're seeing are only partly a result of our trade deficit exploding. We also have logistical issues because you don't have the workers at the ports. Also, you don't have the truck drivers. So it's more, I would say, an issue, although our trade deficit is exploding and we're importing more stuff into the United States, which puts a further strain on truckers, ports, shippers, the global supply chain. It's also a matter of what we're doing domestically from a standpoint of policy. You know, we're paying people to stay home. We've got these medicine mandates coming up that will affect it negatively. We could see some of these shortages as a result of people quitting early or just trying to find other work because they don't want to deal with an employer that's going to force them to inject a foreign substance into their body. There's a lot of variables that go into that. But the bottom line there is that you could see the dollar go up, causing big problems globally, while at the same time, the dollar depreciating in value against goods and services in the United States because there's just less stuff and therefore the price of that stuff goes way up. And then people say, well, George, we could just produce that stuff in the United States. No problem. That's actually a win-win. No. You don't understand. First of all, that would take years to do that. And even if we were to do that, now all of a sudden you're going from a labor input cost of, let's say, $2 or $3 an hour to $15 an hour, $20 an hour, $30 an hour. Well, what is that going to do to the price of the good? I mean, there's just people who say that, I always say, be very, very careful what you wish for. Because that could create an inflationary wave that would make 2020 and 2021 look like a walk in the park. And that's assuming that we could create the manufacturing plants to produce that stuff here within 5 years, which I doubt we could. So that's really the risk, or the big risk for China falling apart that I see. And there's a lot of cross currents there, though. It's weird. It's just this kind of deflationary global pressure, while at the same time you have inflationary pressures domestically in the United States. So how that plays out, I'm not sure, but I think it's obviously something that we need to be considering right now. Now, as far as the energy crisis, this is also something that could create massive systemic risk, but oddly enough, I don't know that it would create the dollar problem outside of the United States, but it would create the dollar problem inside the United States for shortages. If we have shortages of energy, then we're going to have shortages of everything because it just trickles down. Energy is the economy. I mean, you've got to listen to Art Berman and how he describes it. And that energy is economic output at the end of the day. So if we have less energy, then we are going to have far less economic output. We're going to have far fewer goods and services. That means prices goes up. That means we have less access to stuff. That means standard of living goes down. So you know, Benjamin, there's another probably 5, 6, 10, 20, 100 things that I could throw into that list that would be a considerable systemic risk to the entire financial system. You're picking out two very good ones, but the bottom line is the global economy is in a very precarious position. And I would argue the US economy is in even more of a precarious position. I mean, we are teetering on the edge of a financial disaster to the magnitude of which I don't think we've seen in the United States, or we haven't seen for at least 100 years. And that would include the Great Depression. What people need to understand is that you have to produce more than you consume. Another way to say that is you cannot consume without producing. And if you consume without producing, if you consume more than you produce for a sustained period of time, that's going to come around and bite you in the rear end. And so if you do that as a society, like we have in the United States, at some point in time, you're going to have to pay the fiddler. And I think that time is approaching very quickly. Now, is that in a deflationary deleveraging, an inflationary deleveraging? My guess would be an inflationary deleveraging, but only time will tell. But you just can't. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to look at it in a very simple economy that I use in my whiteboards, that you've just got one farmer that produces cows, one that produces corn, one that produces cotton or wheat or whatever. And if they're not producing anything, they can't consume. They can't. And what happens, how does a society become richer? Is they produce more than they consume, so other people don't have to produce those goods. Then those other people don't have to rely on farming, so they can be doctors, they can be teachers, they can be police officers, they can be firefighters. You see, that's how an economy grows in a way that's sustainable, is it produces more than it consumes. You see, we have done the opposite in the United States. And now we're at a point where almost 100% of our consumption is a byproduct of asset bubbles. So, I mean, you've got to think about that. Let's just say that you've got a teacher in California. And 10 years ago, they bought a house for, let's just say, $200,000. So they put down, let's say, 20 grand. And that teacher makes, what, 50, 60 grand a year? Well, if they bought the right house in the right area, that house could now be worth 1.5 million. So let's just assume they've never made more than 50 grand a year. They have no savings whatsoever. They put 20 grand down. And now they sell their house and pocket, let's just say, $1 million. Think about the additional purchasing power that person has. Think about how much more they can consume than they could before that. But how much more did they work? How much more did they produce? Zero. Nothing. You see, in that one example, is indicative of our entire economy. So you can see when you use the example of one person, how that is unsustainable. At some point in time, the game of music chairs stops. And when it does, then the United States and the American citizens will have to go back to consuming at a level that is consistent with what they produce. And just think about that for a moment. Just think about what the standard of living would be in the United States if we could only consume what we produced, or at least not literally. Obviously, we'd have trade and we have imports and exports and whatnot, but we could only consume at the same level in which we produced. I mean, the United States would literally be Mexico. It would be, and anyone that says, oh no, we're the richest country in the world, they just don't get economics. They don't get it. They either just can't understand it, or they haven't taken the time to do the research. So that's really the bottom line. And so you're saying, well, you know, what is the catalyst going to be? I don't know, Benjamin, but it's going to be something, because it's completely, what we're doing now is completely unsustainable. And especially when you have these labor shortages that have been produced by all of the government interventions, producing these economic distortions, malinvestment, misallocation of resources. And then on top of that, you say, okay, every single business with over 100 employees, you basically have to fire 20% of your staff. I mean, what are you doing? That is madness. Just from a strictly economic standpoint, that is insanity. And if you think we've got shortages now and the standard of living is decreased, just give it a couple months. Just wait. Just wait till the holidays and go over to the grocery store, go over to the mall, go over, you know, wherever. It's going to look like communist Russia from the standpoint that, sure, you might have dollars. You might have tons of dollars. And sure, your 401k might be up. Your crypto account might be up. Your gold might be up. Your real estate might be up. But who cares? There's nothing to buy. And obviously, I'm taking it to an extreme. There will be things to buy. I'm not saying that in a few months, everyone's going to be starving and living in caves and whatnot. But I'm saying the amount of stuff that you have access to will be dramatically less than, in my opinion, and there's no certainties, there are only probabilities, but I think the probability is high that the amount of goods and services you have access to will be dramatically less in 3 months, 6 months than it is even today. And if we continue down this path of just money printing and trying to consume without producing anything, paying people to stay home, and then making it almost impossible for small and mid-sized businesses to exist, you're only going to get more of the same. And that's going to filter through into the energy sector, which will trickle down into everything else, which will exacerbate the problem. Question, I know you have 10-80-10 rule and cash is separate. How much of the percentage would you have cash over? It depends. That's why I never talk about that, because it's so based on the individual. And like right now, you know, I'm investing, not a lot, but I'm investing a little bit in the YouTube channel and the Rebel Capitalist channel. As most of you know, we're doing like five, six, eight. There was a day last week where I did seven videos in one day, seven live streams. I'm just trying to do, you know, like the news and talk about freedom, liberty, and macro, all the stuff that's really important to us. But that takes money. So I have a little bigger cash position now than I normally would. But that's just an example of that. That's why I can't answer that question, because it's so much based on your job, your business, your age, you know, the probability of you still having a job in 6 months. I mean, unfortunately, we're at that point in town where we have to ask those questions. So, and then it also depends on what you think the probabilities are that we have, that when this ends or how this ends, does that look like a deflationary deleveraging or an inflationary deleveraging? That would also be a variable in how much cash you want to keep on the sidelines as dry powder. Just watched Meet Kevin with Ivory Hector. Okay, I'm not sure who Ivory Hector is, but I'm really good friends with Meet Kevin. He's you know, I've got a tremendous amount of respect for Kevin. He's just a kid, and I don't know if I've ever seen a kid that age that is as ambitious as he is. Maybe me. Maybe that's why he's just a great kid, but maybe that's why I like him so much, because I see so much of myself at that age in him and what he does. But okay, so the whistleblower at Fox News for them trying to change the narrative of her story needs to have her on your channel. You good? Okay, I mean, I'll take that into consideration, Daniel. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Question: the $1 trillion platinum coin is GIS an attempt to stay constitutional, and that if we valued gold and back paper currency units, Russia have more gold, making them more wealthy in currency units. Let's see. Question: the $1 trillion platinum coin, an attempt to stay constitutional? I don't think it's an attempt to stay constitutional, Wayne. We listen, the Constitution, I think a lot of our problems would be solved if we just went back to acknowledging and adhering to the Constitution in the way it was written originally. But we haven't done that in years. I mean, the Constitution, unfortunately, I don't think it really, I hate to say it doesn't mean anything, because it really, really does, and it really should. But I don't think any of the politicians pay any attention to it. It's just we've turned into a country of men, and we've abandoned being a country of law. So these you know, executive orders, and I mean, Trump did it just like Obama, just like Bush, just like Biden. I mean, they just rule by decree. And unfortunately, that's the country we live in now. And that's another thing that I would say is a big systemic risk. Because you get someone in there that is a Mussolini or a Stalin, and all of a sudden we've set the precedence for them ruling by decree and completely ignoring the Constitution. Where does that road lead? And then we look at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Act is what is supposed to constrain them, and they just completely ignored it back in March of 2020. And did the CNBC, did Bloomberg, did anyone call them out on it? No. I mean, that's why one of the main reasons we did the FOIA request, myself and Robert Barnes, because I was at dinner with Barnes, and this was in Vegas months ago. And I said, how on earth can they get away with that? That is a blatant violation. And what I'm referring to specifically is buying junk debt, buying corporate debt. And sure, they did it with a special purpose vehicle and whatnot, but give me a break. Is there any acknowledgement to the spirit of the law, which it's so obvious they violated? And that was pretty much the catalyst to why we decided to do that FOIA request, which is we're in the process of doing now, and hopefully that turns out well. It's a long process, but you know, Barnes is still fighting the good fight. We'll see how it turns out. But yeah, so I mean, that's my point, is I wish we could go back to having some sort of respect for the Constitution and making sure that that constrained the government. I mean, that's really what the Constitution is all about. It's constraining the government. But I mean, what's the saying? I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, but it's something to the effect of the government should fear the people instead of the people fearing the government. Or when the people fear the government, bad things happen. That's basically the takeaway there, is when the people fear the government, that's when it goes south real quick. When the government fears the people, that's when you have progress. That's when you have freedom. That's when you have free market capitalism. And that's when a society flourishes on net balance. So I've talked about precious metals. What's my view on uranium? In Rebel Capitalist Pro, we've talked about uranium since I started it. I mean, we started talking about that way back in before March of 2020. And so I've got to give full credit to Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh, my partners in Rebel Capitalist Pro. And so when everything kind of took a dump, for lack of a better term, in March, that's one of the things that I loaded up on, was uranium, because everything was cheap. And you guys know how I invest. I mean, I buy stuff and then I forget that I even have it. And I don't check it at all. I always forget my password to my account, my brokerage account. I have no clue what it is. I check it maybe once every 4 months at the most. But I know when I looked at uranium the other day, it was way, way up. So that was something I made a lot of money on. And it's not that I did anything genius. I just simply bought things when they're cheap and you sell them when they're expensive. It's just, at the end of the day, it's really not rocket science. But as far as where it is now, usually when you get a uranium bull market, it really runs. If you look at what the price action historically is of a uranium chart. Now, I'm going to have to go back and look at that pretty soon, because like with the oil positions that I took in March of 2020, my rationale there was that oil, historically speaking, when you adjust the price for inflation, under $30 a barrel, it's pretty cheap. Over 80, it starts getting expensive. And if I want to stick to my guns and abide by my own investing rules, which I do, that means that I bought it under 30. That was around 20, 25. But now that we're close to, I think last week we got over 80, if I'm not mistaken. So that means that I'm going to need to start selling, yeah, especially if it stays over 80. And I think I might do that with selling calls, but that's a completely separate topic. But so, yeah, I'm going to have to do the exact same thing with uranium and see kind of when it's historically cheap, when it's historically expensive. And I'm going to have to think about that. Now, you may say, well, George, it's, you know, we're in a super cycle. You could miss all these gains in oil and in uranium. Yep, you're right. You're right. But those are the rules. And I just stick by the rules. I figure that's the only edge I've got. And if I sell oil, that by no means implies that I'm bearish. Absolutely not. Just like when I bought oil at $30 or $25 or whatever it was, I was not bullish. I thought oil was still going to go down. I thought it was going to go down to like $10 a barrel. But I still bought because it was cheap. So I'll keep you guys posted, but that's something that I need to look into as far as where we are, historically speaking, with the inflation-adjusted price of uranium. But my guess is it's still probably pretty cheap, Lewis. I don't think it's in the area that oil's in right now, but I'll have to look into it. So you rolled 401k into self-directed IRA. Should I buy rental property in Boise now with high price interest or wait? I can't answer that question, Heather. It's too broad. I can't even tell you what I would do because I don't know any of the numbers in Boise, and real estate is so localized. What I can tell you is that you need to be very, very careful with real estate. There's some opportunity there because I think the opportunity is in the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. But if you don't know what you're doing in real estate right now, you're playing with fire. Do you find yourself using technical or fundamental analysis? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start just way macro. And then once I make a decision from a macro level, then I'm going to get more into the weeds and say, like, well, let's go back to oil. So I didn't buy barrels of oil. When I keep saying that I bought oil, I should be more specific. I bought oil producers. I didn't buy oil futures or something like that. So if I've got an idea, if I say, okay, oil's cheap, I want to go long oil, then you've got to be more specific, narrow it down to, okay, what companies do you want to buy? And then you need to go through and do kind of the fundamental analysis. But I start with the technicals and just look at the charts. If you want to call that technical analysis, I don't know that it really is. I'm not looking for like a 50-day moving average. I'm not looking for a head and shoulders pattern. I'm not looking for, buying or selling on volume. Although I do find those things interesting, but that doesn't really motivate my decision. But once I make that macro observation, then yeah, you got to look at the fundamentals. If China's economy is imploding, will it unravel to Belt and Road Initiative and generally their plan for world domination? I mean, it won't be good for it, but I think longer term, there's a high probability of that coming to fruition. I mean, Jim Rogers says this all the time. You got to look at when the United States came to global dominance from an economic standpoint. It's not like you just go there in a straight line. Look at the 1800s. That was a great, for the most part, that was a great century for the U.S. economy. But yet we had inflation, during the Civil War. We had the Civil War. we had a central bank that we got rid of in the early 1800s. We had banking crises. There was a lot that happened, and a lot of bad things happened, a lot of recessions, depressions, but then good times as well. So an economy or a society never just goes up in a straight line. And I think China will have the same outcome. It's going to be interesting how the people, there's going to be a conflict, I think. There's going to be a clash between the people and the powers that be, because it seems as though the powers that be really want to move back to this socialist type of system, or more socialist. I think they see China displaying signs of late stage capitalism. I've talked about that in quite a few videos. But once the people get a taste of free market capitalism, especially when you got $1.5 billion? It's really going to be tough to get that genie back in the bottle. So I think that over the next few years, they're going to probably push more towards this authoritarian type of approach where they have the government, the Chinese Communist Party, has more control over the means of production. But eventually that's not going to pan out. And I think the people are going to win in the end. And when they do, if they do, then I think China gets right back on track. And I think in 30, 40 years, we look back and they'll most likely have the largest economy in the world. My favorite movies or TV shows? I don't really watch movies anymore because I think people that are my age can probably relate to this, that the movies now, and I'm not just saying that because every generation says that, but it is true. I mean, the movies today are terrible compared to the movies just even in the early 2000s. And one way I can prove that is because when's the last time they came out with an original idea for a movie? Ever? I mean, they just take ideas from decades ago and just do the same thing over and over and over again with a different spin. But even back in the early 2000s, we had original movies and we had comedies as well. Now every single thing's got to be a remake of Ghostbusters or a remake of, I'm sure they'll do Caddyshack, or a remake of this, a remake of that, Spider-Man, you know, Superman, Batman, blah, blah, blah. You know, back in those days, it seems like a long time ago, but they actually had original movies that would come out that were fantastic. Remember Old School? Remember Wedding Crashers? Like, how come we don't have any of those movies anymore? It's because it's just Hollywood has gone woke. So the main objective with movies now has nothing to do with making a great movie. And it just has everything to do with pushing a political narrative. And why is that? I think that's an interesting economic question. Because businesses don't have to make profit anymore. See, we've moved into this world, this economy, where profit doesn't matter as much. Now, it will in the long run. But currently, profit doesn't matter as much as political pull or graft, I believe is what Ayn Rand referred to it as, and which is basically political pull. So now you can actually make more money through the Cantillon effect than you can by actually working hard, producing a great product, and producing a profit. I mean, what was it in 2019? I believe 70% of the businesses that went public were not making a profit. Come on. So in a world where it is more valuable to have political pull than profit, you don't have to have a great product so long as the government likes it. And I think that's the world we're in right now. But that goes back to people just forgetting as a society that you have to produce more than you consume. But, you know, we've been able to print money and create asset wealth, and that's created our ability to consume. But at some point, that game ends. And until that time, I don't think you're going to see very good movies, because they have no incentive to create a movie that people actually want to watch. They may have a bit of an incentive there, but you know what I'm saying. That incentive is equal to their incentive to gain favor with a political party that is either going to help them get rich or maybe prevent them from further regulation down the road. I mean, if you sit there and you got to ask, well, why is Warren Buffett, you know, why Facebook, and I'm not going to stick up for Facebook, but you ask them, why is Zuckerberg donating $500 million to the Democratic Party? And you can say it's because he's crazy, you know, he's woke, he's all these things. Maybe. I think obviously that's a probability. But I think there's also a probability that he knows that the group that's most likely to come after him are the Democrats, because historically they're the ones that go after corporations. Now, I know that the Republicans may go after them, but usually the Republicans don't go after even big business to the degree that Democrats do. So he could be, or why did Bezos buy the Washington Post? Yeah, it's I think a big part of it is that they want political favor, because they know the bigger they get, the bigger target they have on their back. And so, and it's not to say that they're not motivated by this woke agenda, but I think there's a variety of reasons they do that. And I think that gaining political pull is one. So I know that didn't answer your question, but I like a lot of the movies from the, you know, the 90s, the early 2000s. I think that's when they were the best. I mean, I just went and saw this recent James Bond movie, and it's just, give me a break. Come on. If you guys saw it, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's just so disappointing. That's why I don't like going to movies anymore, because every time I just walk away, just disappointed isn't even the right word. Just sad, I think, is a better word, because I'm just sad that our world has come to this point where it's no longer about creating stuff that is amazing. And so that's, see, when I'm going and watching a movie like that, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm just thinking about every single time I see that woke agenda being pushed, it just reminds me of the state of the world in which we live, and it makes me sad. So if you haven't seen the movie, it's not a bad movie. It's I think in a lot of ways it's a pretty good movie. I mean, you're going to be on the edge of your seat, but it's not a James Bond movie. I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. It's maybe a good movie, but it's not a James Bond movie in no way, shape, or form. And so, and I think the reason why goes back to what I was saying earlier. As far as TV shows, I don't really watch TV. But the last show that I did watch, I would just buy it on iTunes, was The Office. So definitely my favorite show of the last, you know, however many, 10, 12 years, something like that, was The Office. Hands down, easy question to answer.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What do you think the probability is the supply chain issues are deliberate? I mean, I think that they were produced as a result of something maybe deliberate. When you look at the government intervention, when you look at the lockdowns, when you look at the stimmy checks, I mean, that could have been, intentional to gain more power and control. But I think the unintended consequence, I think that is an unintended consequence. I don't think that's an intended consequence. That's probably what I'm trying to say. And I think it's just, but although it may be an unintended consequence, I think the fact that it's happening, the politicians and the global elite see it as a good thing, because you never let a crisis go to waste. And so the more crisis that we have around us, the more power and control the average Joe and Jane will give to those people who have an insatiable lust for that power and control. So I think that's the best way I can answer the question. What is the probability that stimmies come before the crash versus after the crash? Well, we still have stimmies right now. People forget that. The child tax credit or whatever, that's basically a stimmy. And also, let's not forget, stimmies didn't come exclusively in the form of checks. They also came in the form of what you did not have to pay. So it's not just the income side of the profit and loss. It was also the expense side. So if you have your expense, let's say if you don't have to pay rent, if you don't have to pay mortgage, that's a stimmy. That's a stimmy. You have much more money, disposable income, at the end of the month than you otherwise would. So that's, although it's coming to an end, that's still a thing in a lot of state. And then let's, you know, be honest, we still have welfare, we still have these benefits, those aren't going away. So we still have stimmies to a certain degree. And I would also say that the asset prices are in a way a stimmy, because that's just basically quote unquote free money that you're getting from the Fed increasing the size of their balance sheet. Or so let me connect those dots. So your portfolio, your 401k or your crypto portfolio, the one of the main reasons that has gone up is because of the Fed increasing the size of their balance sheet and doing $120 billion worth of QE. Now, there's not really a direct causal effect, but there's an indirect causal effect through the psychology that it creates in the market itself by pushing people out the risk curve and also by creating that inflation. So you have negative real yields in the real economy. And then people believing that there's a Fed put. Therefore, they're taking more risk going into the market, buying stocks, buying cryptos, buying NFTs, what have you. So that is adding to people's purchasing power without through central planning, without them having to produce more. So effectively, that is a stimmy as well. But that said, Alex, I think that when we get a downturn in the market, which I'm sure we'll have at some point in time in the future, or if the housing market starts to deteriorate in nominal prices, they're definitely going to step in and do more stimmies. I think that eventually we'll have some form of UBI, explicit UBI. And I think the timing on that will be predicated upon when we have the next crash. So let's just say in 6 months, the stock market goes down by 20% in a disorderly fashion. That would prompt, in my opinion, that would get us much closer to a central bank digital currency and UBI. If it happens in 3 months, if it happens in a year, whenever that happens, that's going to light a fire under the central planners to institute UBI and central bank digital currency and ban cash. That's something that really hasn't been in the news lately and people haven't really been talking about. But trust me, that is still a thing. And I believe there's a high probability that that's coming in the future as well. A ban on cash. They're really going to have to implement that while at the same time rolling out this central bank digital currency, which I think they'll do just by having people download an app so they can spend bank reserves as dollars in the real economy. If the government defaults and the dollar crashes, how long would it take banks to freeze your account? Let's think this through, Ken, because I don't know. You're making some assumptions that I don't know are accurate. So the first assumption is if the government defaults, that will crash the dollar. If the government defaults, what would most likely happen is interest rates on government bonds would go up. And again, no certainties, only probabilities. The probability is if you got 10 economists, 9 of them would say, I shouldn't say economists because economists usually don't know what the hell they're talking about. But if you had some really smart FinTwit people, I think the majority would say, okay, if the government actually does default, then interest rates on the long end of the curve go up 10-year, 30-year. That would increase interest rates in the real economy. And I don't know if that's dollar bearish. I think their response would be dollar bearish because I think they would come right out and say, okay, now we've got to implement MMT. We've got the government is the currency issuer, not the currency user. Therefore, we shouldn't have defaulted in the first place. And we can just write checks and that will work. And I don't think initially, if they do it that way, it won't work. The Fed has to actually send the checks because when you're sending out a check, you're sending out a liability to a bank and you'd have to back it up with an asset. And if it's coming straight from the government, the way it's set up now, that there's the Treasury doesn't have, it wouldn't be sending out an asset. It would just be sending out the liability where the Fed would actually be able to create the liability to to match up with the the Fed would be able to create the asset, for the liability that it's sending out, because the Fed can create bank reserves, the Treasury can't, as of right now. And I'm sure that would change. So I don't know that just because it defaults, the dollar crashes, it might actually do the opposite, especially on the DXY. How long would it take the bank? Well, there's going to be a lot of cross currents there on the DXY, though. But yeah, the bottom line is I don't know that it crashes. How long would it take for the banks to freeze our account? Yeah, if the government defaults, and I don't know if that would really prompt the banks to freeze your account. The banks are flush right now with reserves. So I don't know that there's not really an incentive for them to freeze your account. Because even if you were to, so what you're assuming is that they don't have the money because it's fractional reserve. And that's, to a certain extent, that's true. But the banks are so flushed with reserves that they could turn those reserves into currency, hard currency, and get that to you in a certain time frame. You got to keep in mind that the banks have $4 trillion. Plus, last time I checked, in reserves. And going back to the GFC, they might have had, my goodness, maybe 40 billion. So 40 billion compared to 4 trillion. I mean, it's a whole different world now. So I don't know that that's a huge risk. It can definitely happen, that's for sure. But I don't know if it's as big of a risk. And I think there are other things that are far more probable to happen as a result of the government default above and beyond the dollar crashing or banks basically doing a bail-in. Do interest rates matter on treasuries when the Fed buys them if gains are returned to the treasury anyway? I mean, I think your question is the Fed buys a 10-year at 1.5%, interest rates go up to 3%. That means they take a big haircut on the face value of that bond if they go to sell. So in a case where they would do quantitative tightening, they're reducing the size of their balance sheet, they're selling bonds, and they're selling them at a lower price than they bought them. So does the interest rate matter? I don't think so. I don't think so, because I don't think it really impacts the Fed one way or the other if they take a haircut. And, you know, is it going to impact the Treasury? Maybe a little bit, but I think we're talking about, we're getting into the minutiae, and I don't think at the end of the day that really matters too much, because let's just say they took a haircut that transferred over to the Treasury, and or the profit transferred over to the Treasury, and that's, let's just say $30 billion. Okay, well, you're dealing with a government that's spending $8 trillion a year. So I don't know if an extra $50 billion is really going to make a difference. It's not going to be a game changer. And then with the Fed, I think they could have negative equity. If you guys go back to my conversation I had with Richard Werner, I think he would be in the same camp, that there's really nothing that would prevent the Fed from continuing to exist or continue to print bank reserves, even if they were insolvent. Yeah, I don't know that that's really going to impact things one way or the other. All right, guys, let me go ahead and do some shout outs. I've got to fire over to the live stream for Rebel Capitalist Pro. And just as a reminder, I know we've got a lot more people on right now than we had at the beginning. I'm going to be doing an RV tour, driving from Arizona to Florida, just pretty much straight down I-10. This is going to be like November 7th or 8th. And then we're going to drive maybe 4 days to get to Miami. And each night we'll be stopping at an RV park along the way. So maybe El Paso, San Antonio, Houston, you know, kind of, I don't know. We'll have a calendar all set up, and we'll just do maybe a barbecue. So if a couple people want to come and hang out and talk macro and liberty and economics with myself, you're more than welcome. And if you're interested in doing that and finding out the specific locations and dates and, you know, where we'll be and when, just go ahead and email my assistant. Her name is Adriana, and her email address is contact@georgegammon.com. And then when we have that schedule set up, I'll have her email you, and then hopefully we'll see you on the road. I think it'll be fun to do a little barbecuing at an RV park and have some beers and talk about what's happening in the world. All right. Shout outs, Miles in the house, Joshua Tober, Doc Oz, Truth, RR, Becky B, Angel Cordero, Silverman, Hi Kick Exp, Brandon Smith. Let's go, Brandon. Average Jane, something here, Harvey 82, Ukbe Nguyen, Bull Dag, Ramari Nigger Gira. Oh boy, that's tough to pronounce. We'll just go with Ramari. Sorry about that, Ramari. Reggie Willis, OG Foundation, All Nighter Hider, Brayton, Gregory Stewart, Mitchell Goslin, Jason Kincaid, Space Vibe Z, Getting Ahead, NACI, Joe's G's, Craft Cannabis Guides, Wayne Smith, Miku, Mateo Bellinger, Camden, David Ross, Joel Doing Joel Things, Jasper the Hairy Caterpillar. Oh, that's awesome. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening, your weekend, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.